Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now the time to do the right, right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it
right. Yes, yes. Let's do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are here in St. Louis, and we are live on Facebook, and hopefully in the very near future, we'll be live on Black Radio Hall of Fame. But until then, we are going to continue to have our guests, continue to engage in these important conversations, pass on knowledge that you may or may not know or have, but it's all about connecting the folks who are on the battlefield, and they are part of a number of struggles. And they, as you will find out today, they're doing that through art, through literacy. And so we have two special guests today. But I want to just say a minute to our brothers and sisters in the Caribbean who've been hit with Melissa. And some of us have folks down there, both friends and relatives. And so, you know, it definitely is not an eerie time for the Jamaicans. This is the worst storm ever. It was worse than Katrina, y'all, if you could even imagine that. So that tiny island is going to endure a lot in the days, months, and years to come. And so let's send out our thoughts and our heartfelt energies to them for the kind of strength that they're going to need for the recovery process. Some of us know a little bit about that from the tornado that we had in St. Louis that we are still recovering from. So this is the results of global warming. The meteorologists and scientists have already said these episodes will be more intense, longer. And so I just think we need to brace ourselves both for the actual events, but also what we can do to stave off some of the attacks on the environment that have been happening. So particularly from folks who say there's no such thing as global warming or climate changes and all of that crazy stuff. But here we are. Here we are in the midst of chaos. So this is a time when I remind you that we still have a 34-count felon in the White House, totally unhinged, taking us into chaos in many different ways. There are about 42 million Americans who will be losing SNAP benefits come next 48 hours. So we see what the plan is, and he is exhibiting pain and suffering on this country in ways that we have not known before. But we have to stay strong, and we have to be strategic. We have to be organized. Some of us are still using the energy from the No Kings protest so that we make things happen locally. And that's what we should continue to do. And we're going to give some places and some things that people can get involved in St. Louis before we leave the air. So we have one of our guests here, and hopefully the other one will join us at some point during the broadcast. But we have with us right here is Vivian. And Vivian Gibson is the author of The Last Children of Mill Creek. And even though that book is about 5 years old, it is still a need for us to talk about Mill Creek. And this is because we have the MAGA folks are in erasure mode. So they are erasing history of Black folks, erasing the culture of Black folks, erasing the accomplishments of Black folks in this country. So I think it is even more important that we lift up lost history, because a lot of folks, even in St. Louis, didn't even know about Mill Creek. And so here's the author with us today, and we'll be talking a little bit about how this project came about. Welcome, Vivian.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, one of the things, because you had not written a book before, what was it about this story that you thought needed to be told? Because there's other communities like Mill Creek, maybe not the kind of definition, because it was a lot of people there. But, you know, in my book, Ferguson is America, when I was really trying to research some of the history of how land is taken and how people are pushed off land, I came across Hooverville in St. Louis, which was on the riverfront. And I don't think a lot of people knew that the St. Louis Hooverville was the largest in the country. Mm-hmm. And it was not as large as Mill Creek, but it's about 5,000. But it also had definition and organization. It had their own churches, their own social institutions, even their own little mayor. So and for the very same reasons, they were bulldozed, even though they went well beyond, I think, the time that they intended to, because that was during the Depression, mm-hmm. and the folks had to come together to organize and support each other. So that's the way that they did that. And that's the way the Hoovervilles did it all across the country. But it was declared a slum in 1936, and those people were completely like bulldozed off. So this notion of slum when it comes to poor working class Black folks, is that what motivated you to really write the book?
No, actually, I was probably the last one to get on board the concept or the idea of writing this book. I was simply writing stories of my childhood. I retired, and I was not a writer, as you said. But I'd been writing all along, but primarily ideas and memories. My mother died when I was 27, and at that age, I realized how little we had talked about. You know, you think you have all the time in the world with your parents, and you've asked all the questions, but I hadn't. And having free time after retiring, I joined a creative writing workshop of senior citizens. So it was basically, I'm writing these stories, you all tell me if they're good, kind of thing. And one thing led to another, and there was so much interest in what I was writing about. And it was basically my childhood, and my childhood was in Mill Creek. So I wish I'd had a more noble reason for writing this book, but it was basically my parents died before I had children. I wanted them to know what it was like to be with my children, primarily my mother, because I adored her. And so that's what I was writing about. But as I shared, more and more people were saying, I never heard of this. Where was that? This is so interesting. 20,000 people were displaced. All the businesses and the churches and the institutions and the culture, I realized had been erased, or was this close to being erased anyway. And as I tried to do research beyond my memory, there was very little. And so I just thought this is important. But I was reluctant because I was not a writer by training, but I've been writing all my life. I'm a storyteller naturally. And it was an important story. And so as it progressed, I realized how important it was. And that's what I did. And you're right. It's 5.5 years since this book is published. The sales have not gone down. And my speaking on it and teaching about it has not lessened at all. So there's still so much interest in this erased Black community and so many more around the country and the world.
Yeah, I think it's, I just want to clarify, because I think in many ways we use the term similarly. So yes, you've always been a writer. So don't say you're not a writer. You may not have been an author, which is a published writer, but
which
most
I am
of
now.
Us are, yeah, most of us are writers, and so and folks like us are the storytellers, the griots, to make sure that the history gets passed down. And so even though you started with your own particular history, it comes a time when you're going to interact with other families who live there, and it gets amplified and it starts to grow. And next thing you know, you got the children of Mill Creek and not just a child of Mill Creek.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about the process after you wrote the book, because now you're morphing into a video, a documentary that includes many other voices. So talk about that for us.
Yeah, it was also very clear. First of all, I come from a large family of 8 children and 9 if you count a friend of my brother's who came for dinner one night and stayed for 4 years. and I write about that. But one thing you realize when you write about yourself or write a memoir that you can't write about yourself without including all the people around you. And in my case, there were lots of children. And in the community, there were lots of children and who were my friends. And so I wrote about our lives, what it was like to be in this environment, almost a cocoon of safety and support, not even realizing what segregation was and what deprivation was. So I wrote from this perspective of a child so that I could just show, almost like a camera on my shoulder, what I was hearing, what I was seeing, how people made me feel, how supported I was, how free I felt in this environment that had, as I was older, came to realize what it all meant, but I didn't know it then. And so I think in doing that, I revealed a culture, what W.E.B. Du Bois calls behind the veil. How did we exist in this segregated environment and still keep a society, a community going for ourselves? And it was very surprising. You talked about the documentary. I also knew later on, a couple of years later, after the book was so successful, but there were other stories that were similar to mine, but maybe even different from mine. And so I wanted to share the story of other people, other children who may have been older than me and had different experiences. So I identified 18 individuals who were children and young adults around the time that Mill Creek was demolished, and interviewed them for my documentary just to get more perspective on what it was like to live in this community and then watch it disappear. And so that's what the documentary is about. But it's the process of doing both the book and the documentary was just so revealing to me. I was learning as I was writing. I would write about myself, but then I had to do research to support some of the things that I remembered as a child, you know.
Right, right.
Even with my siblings who were all older than me, I would take the same situation and say, well, what about this? And what I remembered as a 8-year-old or a 10-year-old, my then 16 or 18-year-old siblings saw it in a very, very different way. And I thought other people in that community might have different perspectives too. And I continued to learn. And once I started writing and people started reading the book, I started getting bombarded with other people. Excuse me. Saying, I live there too, and this is where I live. You know, we have something here in St. Louis called the St. Louis question, where people ask you what school you went to, what high school. And part of that is to identify exactly where you are in or were in this society, what community and that sort of thing. You could determine it by what high school you went to. Well, I have a Mill Creek question, and it's basically, where did you live? And or people will volunteer. I don't even have to say. People will yell at me on the street and say, I lived at 2718 Clark. I went, yay. Yeah. And they just want to let me know that they're from that community. They were there. And it's been a really community building exercise for me, for people to just come out and thank me. Black people, thank me for telling the story.
Yeah. And I can't really believe that, because what you're doing is actually honoring their existence, honoring their childhoods, honoring their families. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking, Vivian, it reminds me of, I had some of the survivors of Pruitt-Igoe who were survivors of the, what I call the biological warfare, mm-hmm. that when they dropped the spray on those children. And one of the things that resonated with me while you were talking is the kind of joy when they talk about their childhoods. Yes. So when people look at Pruitt-Igoe, they have very negative connotations. Images yes. come up of, like, you know, all negative. And mm-hmm. yet these folks felt, as you said, safe. They felt cared for. They mm-hmm. felt loved. And people find that hard to believe. But I think that was, for me, I think it was the way that we operated as Black families under segregation in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s. Mm-hmm. We did have some community. We didn't have a whole lot, but what we had, we shared it, and we shared it with folks who then reciprocated. And so that's what community is really all about. Mm-hmm. And I think about this whole notion of where people live, and it's, since I did the book, I've been thinking a lot more about land, how people occupy land. And I was talking to you before we went on air about just coming back from Kalamazoo College, where they did a project about land and location and people on those lands. So Kalamazoo is in Potawatomi land. And so we had some folks from that tribe come in. But this notion of land is so important that I don't think people really understand what it means. Mm-hmm. And even in my book, I talk about this concept of root shock, which comes from Mindy Fully Love. And one thing she talked about, I mean, she had a psychological trauma tied to the land when you're just uprooted. Yes. And I think about when you get uprooted like that, it's almost like being in a natural disaster. I mean, you know, it's hard to get that connection. And one of the things we know that has happened is that most Black and Brown communities were pretty much decimated when they ran the highways through there, which is what happened with Mill Creek in 59. So they have a systematic way of tearing up and uprooting our communities under the guise of what? Progress. Yeah. So can you go a little bit deeper into what, for starting with, what the dimensions are for Mill Creek, so people who live in St. Louis can say, okay, that's the perimeter. Now I know where it was, because you don't know that now.
Because there's nothing there. And that's what people will all, can you do a tour? I said, there's nothing there. There's nothing from Mill Creek. Well, I want to be careful to explain that. When you see a map of Mill Creek today, one is in my book, and you see them all over now, that is the urban renewal footprint of Mill Creek. And it starts at Grand Avenue, which is the center of St. Louis University. So it's Grand Avenue at Lindell. Going east, Lindell merges into Olive Street, and you continue east to 20th Street, which is where our new soccer stadium is. You then go south on 20th Street and you are at the intersection of Market and 20th Street, and that's Union Station. That is our major train station that's been there since the 1800s. It was adjacent to this Mill Creek Black community. You continue on 20th Street, you pass over railroad tracks and go, you get to Shoto. A lot of people don't remember that it was all the way over to Shoto because there are train tracks in the middle. Then you come back west to Grand, and that's 465 acres of land that was the heart of Mill Creek and the heart of downtown St. Louis. And when people say that they didn't know that Black people were there, 20,000 Black people concentrated in row houses, no grass, no parks, nothing, just houses and factories and schools and churches. People say they didn't know. I said, how could you not know? If you drove down Market Street, which was the main thoroughfare in St. Louis, in any city, when it's called Market Street, it's the center of town usually. All you had to do was look right or left, and there were Black people walking around because it was a walking community. So people were on the streets. So I don't know how people could say that they didn't know we were there. They don't know. They hadn't heard of us. And I've decided that part of that not knowing was the name Mill Creek. It wasn't really until urban renewal that that strong identity of that name, Mill Creek, was assigned to that space. Before that, Black people lived along Mill Creek, which it was a creek that went straight through the city. It actually was the major waterway that the city grew up around, and people don't even know that. It is now those railroad tracks that I talked about earlier. There was a cholera epidemic in the late 1700s. They had to drain it, and eventually they put railroad tracks there, and they built Union Station, so people are not even aware. There's Damon. Hey!
Hey, Damon. That's okay. We are glad to have you. You know, we didn't miss a beat, so we're gonna bring you in a minute.
So, Damon, I'm talking about where Mill Creek is or was, and so that people can kind of identify with it, because there's nothing there. But thankfully, because of Damon, you can now go someplace and look and stand and experience Mill Creek in granite. So I hope that helps with, you know, the identification.
Yeah, it does. And I just want to say to the whole thing about what people don't know, I think that, you know, we elders now, we know how people, Black people particularly, live their lives, and usually it's day to day and within a certain block. Mm-hmm. So to be able to venture out and see what's happening, particularly during segregation, that just was not gonna happen. And but, even though segregation has been stripped for the most part in terms of where people can go, folks are still, you know, blinded by like what's in front of them. Like, yeah. You know, why would you look to the left and say, oh, I wonder what that is? Or look to the right, what's that about? Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, we've been like curtailed in so many ways that to venture out and wonder, both with the O and the A, wander and wonder, that has just been like smashed in us. But I think your intro for Damon is a good segue to just bring him into the conversation. And Damon, one thing about you, it's hard to put you in some kind of pigeonhole because, you know, you're an activist, artist, commentary. I mean, so you are all of those things, but your connection to Mill Creek, I think, is pretty powerful, because there is now some physical, symbolic thing that now, if people didn't know about it as they are going into that damn soccer field, they'll have to like look at that. So talk about where that came from. And I know you worked with Vivian, who would tell you the stories to make sure it informed your sculptures. So talk about what that was like and how you came up with the artistic manifestation of Mill Creek.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I want to say thank you for your for even inviting me here, and also like for my tardiness, for forgiving me, you know what I'm saying? Like, I want to say that along the lines of what y'all was just saying, is like, I didn't know about it, you know, how we talk about sacred, like that's where my whole journey starts with this, that like I grew up in East St. Louis, and I had a father that was pretty, you know, pretty militant from top to bottom. He had homework for me that wasn't school homework. He had me learning all this. You know what I mean? Like I had one set of homework.
Yes.
They homework and my homework. And so I was very almost embarrassed that I didn't know that there was a historic Black neighborhood that was a thriving place, that when people talk about Harlem and they talk about these places were wherever Black people congregated, there was one there. And I didn't know that there was one here, right? And so when I first started my journey to that is now this monument, it was basically for a contest that the GRG had put up about they want to design a greenway. And the team that I got with from their research, people that wasn't from St. Louis, that researched up, they went way back and started, you know, not even, it ain't way back. It be like my parents,
y'all
was alive for it. My parents was alive for it. You know, we be trying to talk about these things like they.
Like it's ancient history, yeah.
It's people that we know.
This is living history,
But it was just before my time. But these out of towners, these white folks, the ones that tell me about this. And I was like, well, one, I'm finna do this my section, so y'all can do whatever else up and down, you know, like, but I want to do something right here in this section, mainly so another kid don't have to, you know, go, another Black kid ain't gonna be like, I didn't know about this, you know what I'm saying? Just that the low-hanging fruit is that we can at least alleviate that problem, that won't happen again, you know what I'm saying, for as long as, you know, as long as the thing stands. And from there on, that's when I started working around, well, why don't I know about it? And so if it's a history, and so history is also, it's individual, it's communal, and it's also which community is in charge of writing it down, which individual is in charge of keeping record of things, and that's why we usually left out, because the society that we live in doesn't even see us as people, let alone things outside of I guess capital or what kind of monetary gain you could get out of us. We come over here as property, and they think that of everything that we produce, whether it's art, our music, our culture, our clothes, is something that can be separated from these people, right?
And monetized,
right? And that can, you know, we'll get to that later. But it also is ironic that the only reason this happens is because a lot of money was going to be made in that space, and that isn't escaped on me. I'm not slow. I'm not a, you know, I'm not the artist that's just in his own, you know, high somewhere in their own world. I'm very aware of socioeconomic and political conditions that allowed me to be able to speak about this. You know what I'm saying? But you got to take the good with the bad sometimes. So, or I guess that's the best way I could put it. I need better words around that, later. So when I started this, I didn't know about no soccer team coming. I didn't know none of it. Like this is just a project that I started with this group of people that and through GRG that I want to get see happen, and they want to see happen, right? Along the way, we find investors and the St. Louis SC was one of those people that came in you know, the GRG took them the idea that we, or they knew that we was working on the Greenway. They knew that they was on the Greenway, and this the part that happened, and took them this idea of what I wanted to do, and you know that it resonated with them or whatever it may be. They got on board, and so that's when things got real, and so that and through that part of it, that's when I had to figure out. I learned, and I really appreciate LJC, the architects I work with, GRG, because I didn't know the world around how things physically go up in space, you know, like in a public monument with gas and water underneath things in the middle of a metropolitan, American city, you know, that it ain't just what I've been used to throughout my career. Right. I do what I want. And, you know, I ask permission later, you know, that sort of thing. This is a little bit different because of all the people that was involved. So I learned a lot about materials, infrastructure, but that's when I knew that I wanted to do something about time and history and the idea of history being covered up, but also being excavated. And so you get history from time passing. So now I know that I just keep going down, common denominator, the least, you know, what's the concentrate of whatever I'm talking about, and it becomes time. And so then I'm like, what is the what symbol, no matter where we go, no matter what color you are, gender, age, language, right? What is something that is universal to humanity that is a symbol of time, right? And the thing that I could think back about, like that I've thought of, is the hourglass. No matter where I went, if I showed somebody that, they would know what that meant, right? They would at least know that we're talking about time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and so when you look at those pillars, those are abstractions of the basic shape of an hourglass. Two chambers, one at the top, one at the bottom. And the way that you know time is moving is because the sand moves from the top chamber to the bottom chamber. Super simple, one of the oldest, I guess, technologies we got. You know what I'm saying? One of the oldest technologies that we have as a human race. And so that's why you see the granite and black. I just, you know, one, I like the color black. It's my favorite color. But also we talking, some stuff I don't want it to be too deep. I want it to be real clear. You know, I think it's a mix between how you layer things to be a good artist, right? I think some people, they make things so convoluted and so complex that nobody else gets them. And that's also, I guess, would be my my school of activism, that you one of my teachers, that it's people that are my contemporaries are my teachers, whether it's Kayla Reed, Tef Poe, people I came up with. But the idea that some things you have to, like, if you're trying to get people on one accord, you're not just talking to yourself, right? And public art is not, public art and art in a gallery are two different things. A gallery is made for people with privilege, quite frankly. You got a privilege to sit up here in the middle of the day when everybody else at work and stare at something until it means something to you. That's a lot of privilege, right? Stuff on the street is people. I'm people on a bus stop, people going to work, people moving. Because you catching people of all different walks of life in an environment that you can't control, right? So it has to speak in a different way. So that was another thing that I took into consideration when I was putting this together, the how to physically manifest what Mill Creek, the spirit of what Mill Creek is, right?
And that sand that's in that upper chamber is there. It's fixed as if the memory of the sand of time and memory of Mill Creek is there forever.
Right. We could stop it. And that's one of the main things too, is like if the sand ain't moving, then that means time is stopped. So mm-hmm. and also that rock is limestone. Limestone is indigenous to this place. That's how the alcohol empire that was built here is because of the caves that mm-hmm. was formed, and you could cool things there. And it's something that's very indigenous to this place. And it speaks to even time before that neighborhood, that this place, and there are a collection of memories and histories inside of this soil and this ground. And this collection of stories is something that we're finna take time with and sit with and stop time and put it up as high as possible. Like, you have to confront it. It's not a plaque on the ground. You know what I'm saying? Like, they 15 feet tall, right? So if you walk up on them, you're gonna have to confront this thing that was supposed to be hidden. It was supposed to be forgotten. And so I really appreciate that, Ms. Vivian, that you brought that up, because that was one of the main things. And also those quotes inside of the bottom chamber is because those are quotes from actual people, you one of them, but people that actually lived in that space. And I'm very mindful and strategic about the fact that just because I'm black don't mean that I'm every black person, and don't mean that I went through what y'all went through. And I think that society, especially this country, tries to lump us all together, and then we fight to be individuals, and then we end up doing it to ourselves anyway and lumping all ourselves together anyway, right? Because it's a natural thing to do. So I know that I come from one place. I'm from East St. Louis. It's close. It's not the exact same. I didn't grow up in the same time period. I grew up in the crack era. That's something y'all didn't have to worry about. You know what I'm saying? I grew up in a different context of being black in a space than what you grew up in. So I wanted to let those people that grew up in that world speak to that place that we're supposed to be memorializing or making a monument to. It's not a funeral, so it's not a memorial, right? So and in each one, I also didn't want them to all be chipper and bright memories. Mm-hmm. That ain't the same. One thing about segregation is it superseded class. So all you Black folks, rich, poor, we finna put all y'all together. So right, everybody, right. Some people might have had a great experience. Yeah. Some people might not have had the same experience. But because you were being defined by an arbitrary, an arbitrary attribute, the color of your skin. So all of y'all could get together. All of y'all might not have, they might not all have been Black. They might have just been dark. It could have been Indian people in there. It's just like all y'all Black to us. You know what I mean? And that's how we get, that's how we get our different complexions.
for sure.
About that, that those people were speaking, whether they hear or not, that those people are speaking.
Damon, I want to talk about I'm going to take over as your interview.
No, go. This is a conversation.
I want to talk about our relationship.
Yeah.
You spoke earlier about the fact that you're from East St. Louis and you thought you were familiar with culture and Black struggle, but you had never heard of Mill Creek. So can you talk about mine, your relationship and the relationship with a cadre of other Black elders from that community?
Yes. And I'm glad you asked that, Vivian, because I know that Damon said that working with you all was in the project was one of the most fulfilling moments and experiences that he's had. So that's pretty powerful right there.
Yeah, it was fulfilling for us too.
Yeah, it was a great experience, and it was I learned a lot, and one of the main things that I learned is that people are probably people that's older than me have told me, like, you could see in a little kid who they're going to be at 80 years old. And by being around people, because my parents were older, I came in late. My mom was 42. My dad was 42 and they had me. But it was just them. And my brothers and sisters was more the age that my parents would have normally been. So it was like two sets of parents. But getting to talk to people was such a rich, you've done so much. Like you've done so much, and we forget that everyday survival is a lot, So just the stories that I say something, one thing will spark something, and that people start telling me stories, and that's what I want to. I want to hear about the everyday life, and I didn't want to over-grandize us or make us subhuman. I think that we constantly fight for our humanity, and humanity is getting to be both. So one thing I did learn was I got to see people that had been and that didn't care anymore. there's a thing about getting to an age that I don't care what you think. I'm gonna tell you what's like, this is what I'm saying. I don't, and that sort of candor is rare in the world we live in right now. So that's one thing that I truly appreciated and I try to take and carry with me. But your book was one of my main, I will say that, was one of my main, grounding things that wasn't from the Missouri Historical Society, because it was a memoir. It was
an authentic voice.
Yes, yeah. And it wasn't sterilized to like numbers and like most of the shit most of the things are like these the census and just names of people and what they do. Yeah. It has no soul to it. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of this art is to capture soul. So to be in conversation with another artist that did that lived through it, and I get the honor and the privilege to kind of synthesize some of what you were saying alongside these, like also at the Missouri History Museum, the people that weren't able to ever talk to me, that weren't alive to talk to me, reading those interviews, was also grounding. And also knowing that like, most of the stuff I'm going through, it might change. The technology might have changed a little bit, the access to things. But most of the same problems that y'all had, I got. Yeah. It might look a little different, but it's also a grounding of being a overall universal experience that we got as Black people. That was a big deal for me. I had Miss Gwen was another one that was very supportive.
Gwen Moore.
Every time I see him, Miss Gwen Moore. And some names escape me, but I went to a couple of meetings with just the elders from Mill Creek. I went to
We were just all circled around him.
Yeah. And I will say this, they found me. You know what I'm saying? Whether it was I wanted to or not. You know what I'm saying? I was getting called, and this Mr. So and So. You know what I'm saying? Or no, another good guy, Mr. Gallagher. He was he's very outspoken gentleman. He definitely reminds me of my father and men of that era and the way that they carried themselves. And it was also I lost my parents during this, so it was also it was refreshing to see that energy still alive in people. Yeah. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Because, mm-hmm. at some point, all of these people from this time, me too, all of the people that's my age, they will be gone. After 100 years, it's a cycling out of energies, of certain ethical codes, more with like the way you see the world, you know, like it's a natural progression of evolution. So to know that energy was still here helped me through a lot of things.
Yeah. So, Damon, I want to step back just a minute because I thought it was important for us to hear about the project through the eyes of the artist, because you all look at the world in quite different ways. That's why I like having some kind of affiliation organically with artists, because you just look at the world in a whole different way. So having you go through that and how you sectioned off the pillars, and those are called the pillars of the valley, just so people know. It took some thought to it, but also I think some of that just comes up for artists in terms of what do you want to visualize? How do you want people to visualize what happened at Mill Creek and the stories, the people, the culture, the camaraderie? How do you put that into a monument? So for me, that was quite amazing to hear that process.
Yes, ma'am. I think a lot of times
I talk all the time to students at all levels, and I always end my presentation with Damon and the Pillars of the Valley. And I talk about my favorite parts of the whole monument. And frankly, I don't know if I've ever told you this, Damon, but my favorite part is the numbers on the ground.
Yeah.
And I tell people, I said, don't go there and just look at those 15-foot high pillars. I said, look down and look at the ground. And that tells you exactly where that monument is, and that those are addresses of the homes that were in those two blocks. And then you go from those numbers in the ground, in the cement, I don't know what it is, it's granite below, but it's also a horizontal granite piece that has the names of the people who lived in those houses and those addresses. And not only their names, but their ages and their occupations.
Oh, and my.
Reading the occupations of the people who lived in those two blocks is so powerful. That gives you a picture of what that society was made up of. So it's more than those granite towers or pillars are wonderful, but look down because there's a huge story there. He also gives you the typography of the valley. You know, he has etched out what the land looked like in the 1600s when indigenous people owned it. And how that valley came about. So there's a lot there. And I tell the story every single time, my son.
I remember a conversation that we had, Damon, when you were first working on it. And I was questioning, not disagreeing, but questioning whether or not this was some kind of pacification of people around what happened. And how were we going to make sure that what you were going to create, which was going to acknowledge what had happened, was not a mere pacification, but was going to be powerful enough to have the messages that you wanted as an artist, but also to reflect the wishes and values of the residents of Mill Creek. So I'm just thinking about, was there any opposition that you had to the project? And particularly now that it is where the new soccer is, and I remember there were times when we, not at the soccer thing, but sometimes at the baseball games where we might be using that as a vehicle to pass out leaflets to educate people about a particular issue. And there would be some white people, and I say white, some white people would say, I don't want that. I came here to enjoy myself. I don't want to deal with all that stuff. Yeah. And then I'm thinking about y'all on sacred ground, first of all. Y'all need to know where you are, why you are, and stop acting like you're privileged to be here because you're here because somebody's allowing you to be here. So I know that a powerful piece like that or pieces like that are going to resonate with people in very different ways depending on their relationship to power and relationship to Black folks, relationship to, quote, urban renewal. So what has been your the responses that you all have had to the monument by folks other than the residents of Mill Creek?
Well, great. I'm glad. The last sentence is perfect because the residents of Mill Creek love it. Every last one of them I've ever spoken to.
Yeah.
Those that probably didn't know about it till I told them. Like, you know how I didn't know about it? Like, you didn't know the place existed until you saw this go up. It's to be expected. And I understand. Black people have been, we have been played over and over again. I get it. And that's what I was talking about with the, and that's why I every time I bring this up, every time I speak about this, I feel the need to bring up the fact that I was working on this before these people with money came in here. Because mm-hmm. I think the idea is that they wanted to do something, so they went and got a black face to give them cover. And that's not what that's not what happened. And no matter what I say, it's going to be people to think that anyway. I'm not really, you know.
But if people know you, Damon, there, that's going to be the last thing they think.
I know. And I want to say I appreciate you for the how you asked me those things out of love because you did know. You do know me. That's not what I get all the time. And it's, you know, Miss Vivian, we had a thing at the History Museum where I might have took a little too far. Miss Vivian has seen me get angry about it because it's just disrespectful. You're not disrespecting me. I didn't live there. You know what I'm saying? You like, people want to bring every gripe that they got with somebody to a group of black people that don't have no power, no way, that just scrounged a little bit of power together, but you don't never take it to the people that you got all of these fucking problems with. You know, that's always mm-hmm. boggles my mind. And and most of the time, it's people that look just like me, right? And also people that are my elders, people that's y'all age talking to me like they ain't figured out how this world works mm-hmm. and or why things go the way that they go, and that you can still stand in the fray. And you know what I'm saying? And we still don't have no control over capitalism and how to the degrees that we're talking about, right? And mm-hmm. so I have had a lot of opposition from the people that I wouldn't expect it from. And sometimes it's legitimate opposition. Sometimes it's legitimate questions, like the way you was talking to me about things, because you do know me. Some of it is just jealousy. Mm-hmm. Right? Like some of it, plain and simple. And I didn't think the world, I had to grow up. Sometimes that's what it is. The world is, people are operating, and it don't matter that they look like you or they don't. Some people, mm-hmm. that's just how they move, right? And some things is, I get backhanded compliments. Like, I get these things where it's like, this is beautiful, and thank God you did, blah, blah, blah. But this money could have went somewhere else. As though art isn't a basic necessity of human existence, right? Yeah. Because if it was about food or water, right? And people think that they can survive without it, right? But we don't realize that everything around us, from these things that we are speaking to each other on, mm-hmm. is an exercise in imagination and art. In some way, shape, or form, and so it's a much more religious practice than we give it credit for, because mm-hmm. of the society we live in. If we was live because of what the Western society has done to the ideas of spirituality, to logic and only logic. One thing you were saying earlier about how the artist sees things, and I think there's been this move for people to have to be able to explain everything, and that's not how this works. This is like church, right? Some of it you understand. Right, some of it you understand. Sometimes it's something speaking through, mm-hmm. and you ain't supposed to understand everything. Because if I could put it into words, I wouldn't need art, would I? I would just write a book. Right, some things are a language unto itself that mm-hmm. can't be put into words, and I have to trust and believe that you get something out of it. That you get what I'm giving. Right, mm-hmm. but I get that backhanded compliment a lot, that it could have went somewhere else, until I until I speak with the accuracy and passion that I'm known to speak with. And then,
when I hear people say denigrating art or its role in our society, I do talk about like what this world would be without music, without visuals. Yeah. It would be a damn dead place. And so, but the other, it's not just the aesthetic beauty, it's also the historical affirmation that artists bring. And that's whether you're a photographer, a visual artist, a sculptor, yeah. You are helping to not just interpret, but to make sure that that history, that culture continues. And mm-hmm. I don't know how long these granite statues last, but they're going to outlast me and you. So that the next two generations are going to have the value of what you all have put together. And so to me, that's the beauty of it, is not just the visual. So in the few minutes that we have left, can you tell people exactly where it is? And that, and based on what been said, people need to go and be able to spend some time there, just like soaking it in and looking at it, and not just do a visual and say, oh, I saw it, because...
And looking down.
So many layers. You got to go up, down, really sideways.
Yeah. There's so many layers to this. And that's why I talk about it all the time. David and I got, I think, a really special relationship in the process of putting this together, because sometimes you don't really know something until you have to teach it or explain it to somebody. And talking to him about just the subtleties of the life in that community was just so, so important and vital to me. And this is not our first time speaking on panels together. And I think we still both learn something from each other. And I think he just did this incredible job that, as you said, will be here for a long, long time. Hopefully my book will be here too, but that granite is really, really important. And people ask, why was it important? I mean, this kind of happened during that period when we were talking in the nationally about monuments and the importance of them. So we were right in the middle of that when we were having these discussions. And I always tell people, it's a place for you to come and start asking questions. Why this happened? Where are these people and where did they go and why? And so it's a place to start, especially for students and young people, all these generations to come. So I thank you, Damon, so much for your thoughts and your creativity.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. And the feeling is very much mutual. And I want to second that. I learned a lot from you. And you haven't been in the same way. You had to, you know, you learn by explaining yourself. I had to do it to you. Like I said, like everything, you know, it's a lot of spiritual stuff. But if people don't, you know, why do I want it to be granted? And that conversation with the people that would be viewing it is also mm-hmm. part of it, because art is a conversation, right? And I think that mm-hmm. sometimes a lot of us artists are taught the opposite. You put something up on the wall, people are supposed to praise you for it. You're supposed to be super mysterious. And that's a part of it, yeah. But I think back to public art is not. It's meant to start curiosity and conversation. Mm-hmm. And I hope I hope that's what it does. But to that first question from you, Mama Jamala, it is on Market Street in the center of St. Louis. It's, I think it's the 2200 block.
Twentieth Street to 22nd, I think.
Yes, so that's that first piece, but it's going to go all the way down to Harristowe. That is under construction right now. They took a lane out of the street, one of the biggest streets in one of the main thoroughfares in the city, which is is amazing to me that it means that much. But they like it will terminate at Compton Market. So we actually will be having some later on, well, next month, we'll be having a little bit of an event around that. But the official opening will be happening next year.
Let me just say something about Market, because you mentioned it's an important thoroughfare. And I remember the late and dear to me, Martha Jane West, told me that one of the reasons that The building, which is now Harris Stowe State University, was initially Vashon High School. And instead of putting the front door on the Market side, which was where all the traffic was, they put it on the Laclede side so that white people wouldn't have to watch black kids go in and out of the building. So Damien, what you all are doing with this project is bringing that thoroughfare back into the spotlight, and particularly with now that being a historically black university. So you see how these things like come together in ways that you didn't even expect.
And you know, at Compton and Market, where this ends, was where the former St. Louis Stars Negro League's baseball field was. And currently it is the Black Radio Hall of Fame. So that all of that going down Market Street is just so, so significant, because that was the heart of our commerce. We had churches on Market Street. We had Vashon High School. We had the People's Finance Building on Market and Jefferson. The entertainment district of Mill Creek was that very block, 20th to like to Jefferson, was all the famous ragtime and blues and jazz music in Mill Creek. So it's really so significant.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I think that people are going to be really proud of the finished product. We would be remiss if we didn't tell people that there is going to be a major exhibit of Mill Creek Valley at the Missouri Historical Museum, which kicks off, I think the opening is November 15th, but it's going to go on for several months. So if you miss it, you got plenty of chance to do that. And maybe even do a field trip with your family, your church, your fraternity, your sorority, to go there and then go down a few blocks to go to the monument. So
I have Damon, one more shameless plug before we go.
Okay, please.
Okay, November 15th, the opening of the Mill Creek exhibit is called Mill Creek Black Metropolis. It's going to air and screen my documentary called Mill Creek When We Were There. Will screen on the first day, November 15th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay, so I'm glad you added that, because I didn't remember that being in part of the promo. So we will make sure that people get there. I can't wait to look at it myself. And just so that people know, what's coming up is for the month of November on Voices from the Battlefield. Next week, we're going to have Frederico Lobe, who is one of Missouri's many wrongfully convicted, probably one of the longest cases that the Organization for Black Struggle has been involved in. He's been incarcerated for almost 40 years, not for murder, for alleged rape. So we'll have him on. He's got a featured piece, a podcast that one of the local reporters is doing. And following that, Damon, you'll be happy to hear that Solomon Thurman will be on, and we're going to be talking about the anniversary of the Black aviators in flight over there at the airport. And then after that, we're going to be talking about the Osage Nation's reclaiming of the land and what that looks like, and the many betrayals of this government to the indigenous people of this country. And then finally, closing out November, we will be talking about the ballot initiative to restore the map, not the gerrymandered map, that is going to eliminate the only Black congressperson in Kansas City. So we'll have representatives from people, not politicians, on board. So it's a lot going on, y'all. So don't act like you're spectators. Let's get involved. And if you missed any of the shows, go to JamalaRogers.com and pick those up. And now that we have a visual component, go to YouTube for the Jamala Rogers station, so you can see the lovely faces of the guests. Thank you again, Damon and Vivian. This is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I hope to see you on the battlefield.